Welcome to Book Club for Movies, everybody. It's July 19th now. I'm Ron Miller. He's ready. It's Matt Amberg.
Not.
Player one, as it were.
Okay, there it is. Now I get it. I was confused. For a minute, I was like, am I ready? Yeah, I'm here. We're doing this.
Yeah.
The mic recorder phoner thing is in front of my face, and I can see you. We're talking. Uh-huh. Let's go.
I used to take a line from the movie, but that time is too perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I don't know if I could pull a single line from this movie. I mean, I could. Okay, we'll get there. This is Book Club for Movies, wherein we watch a movie in a week's time, usually sometimes over the course of a week, and then talk about it on Thursdays, which is today.
And
so,
not over the course of a week. We don't talk about it between now and then.
Over the course of an hour, I suppose. Actually, no, wait, 30 to 40 minutes, and then there's some noodling.
You know, let's just go ahead and say we talk about it on Thursdays,
because okay,
I don't want to wrap this up into like constraints, and I don't want to bottle us up.
Yeah, if I get too specific, it only sets us up for failure.
Yeah.
This week, it's Ready Player One. If that's where the joke before came from.
Okay, wait.
There's no time. Matt. Tell us about Ready Player One.
All right, here we go. Ready Player One's going to come at you. 2 hours and 19 minutes. Based on the book by Ernie Cline, written by Zach Penn, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Ty Sheridan, Olivia Cooke, Ben Mendelsohn, Lena Waithe, TJ Miller, and Simon Pegg. This is your Book Club for Movies Ready Player One synopsis.
Okay.
In a virtual world called the Oasis, you can be anybody you want to be. When the creator dies and leaves behind a clue, starting a worldwide race to find an Easter egg that will give them full control of the Oasis, young Wade Watts joins the contest to learn more about the creator and to stop the corporations from owning every ad-free spot in the world.
Nice. I like it.
Yeah, it's not great. It wasn't my favorite one. I had a rough time with this synopsis.
That's how good they are. Like, even your not favorite one is pretty good.
Thank you.
You're player one, after all.
I'm ready.
So, this is based on a book, and
by Ernie Cline.
So who's Ernie Cline?
He's the writer of the book, Ready Player One.
Wow, man, that Ernie Cline. Shoot,
yeah,
I didn't realize. Okay,
yeah, not Ernie Cline from Ohio.
I've never read the book, so I'm not coming at it from that angle. I have heard about the importance of the book. I have heard people talk that very much enjoy the book about the book. So I understand maybe the cultural significance of this thing, especially to our generation in a way, although I feel like this is very much a multi-generational thing. We'll get there as well. So I get it's a book, and I get people love the book. I feel like we've talked about this from time to time for sure. I don't want to get into the whole, not necessarily the adaptation discussion, because I feel like the adaptation discussion is valuable. I still resist the whole disappointment with the movie because it doesn't follow the book.
Oh yeah, yeah. Thing. No, I mean, and we've talked about this. I mean, I come at these things. I mean, there are certainly going to be books and stories that I might have a little more of a reaction to, where I go, oh man, I really am bummed out that it didn't come out this way. But a majority of the time, you know, and I think we touched on this with like Justice League and stuff, I just view it all as the same story. It's an Elseworlds version of something. You know, it's you're not straight adapting anything. You're Elseworldsing it. You're taking something and you're trying to make it fit into a world that it maybe was never meant to fit into. And you know, Watchmen, I guess, is probably a better example than anything else. Is, you know, there is lots of discussion about that adaptation, whether it's good, whether the change to the ending's good, what, you know, all those things. So,
because they changed a lot about that, and I think that's an excellent example, because that's a movie that I think is a great adaptation because the spirit is carried to it in a way. In fact, that might be, I'm an apologist for that movie, so that this might be a bad place to start, but I think it's instructive here, because I know that the book is very important to a lot of people. So I don't want to, like, have you read the book before, actually,
of Watchmen?
No, sorry, Ready Player One. I'm moving back to the movie at hand.
Wait, no, let's do that. Yeah. I have but not. Just, I was going to say, is great. I have no frame of reference here.
Okay, good. So maybe we didn't need to talk about this at all. I don't know.
The nice thing was actually Beth read the book. So she was kind of like, oh, here are the things that I noticed that were different, that were important, and why they were important. And there were a couple of things that Whether or not we get to them, I don't know, because I didn't read the book, so it's right. hard for me to speak definitively on those. But there were a couple things she mentioned very particularly that really frustrated her in terms of the translation to the screen, and with good reason.
I have heard there are some major differences. I'm curious, and maybe, I don't know. In any event, I think it's important that a movie stands on its own, and obviously that's what we're going to get into here anyways.
Yep.
I imagine there would have to be huge differences given the amount of kind of properties that they use. You know,
there is a lot of cameo related stuff from right. from stuff. I mean, all over, you know, from current generation games to stuff from way the hell back. You know, from
right.
from early Atari stuff. So yeah, like licensing has to be a question there.
Yeah, and not that any of that stuff is really plot dependent, kind of. I think they're careful to not make it, well, except for some Atari, except for the actual challenges. Hey, let's get into the movie. So neither of us having read the books, I gotta say, when I first pitched this thing, because I saw this in a theater, a friend called me up and was like, hey, let's go to the cheap seats and see this thing. And I was like, okay, the cheap seats are $8. But
remember when they were three? Four.
I remember when they were one, man. I remember when the dollar theaters were $1.
Was it an actual dollar?
Yeah. Old people. So anyways, I had seen it already. I was like, hey, why don't we do next show on this? And you're like, oh, okay, cool. And then I got to thinking about it. There's a lot in this movie. Like, there's a lot of references. Yes, we talked about that. But there's just a lot.
It, well, I mean, you got to... Look, you got a two hour and 20 minute Spielberg movie. I mean, when does Spielberg make an actual short movie anymore? I don't think he knows how. If it's, you know, under 2 hours with that guy, I feel like it's impossible. But
yeah
I mean, there's a bit to unpack here. You know, he's trying to do a lot of things. There's a lot going on here, and you've got a lot of moving parts, a lot of characters, a lot of story that you're trying to get pushed into 2 hours and 20 minutes.
So I ended up watching it three times, basically.
Wow.
Like once in the theater, and then I came back and actually, there's a kid's movie in there. It's kiddish. I thought my kids would enjoy it, so I actually edited a PG version for my kids. So I kind of watched it when I did that, and then I watched it this third time with my family. So I have a handle on it now, but it's still daunting in a way, because I do believe there's more to this thing than meets the eye. But I guess just a lot meets the eye is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Anyways, so the movie begins with the premise that these two guys, very much a Jobs Wozniak combo here.
Yeah.
In fact, Simon Pegg's character, Ogden Morrow, he says, call me Og, you know. And there's an article, too, that likens Mark Rylance's character, who is Spielberg's new dude.
Yeah.
First time I saw him was in Bridge of Spies.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet.
He's fantastic.
You love him.
He's a cool dude. I've never disliked a thing he's done, honestly. And I don't know if he's done anything before Bridge of Spies, for that matter. Probably has.
We'll find out. We'll use the internet one day.
But there's at one point there's like a fake Newsweek or Time magazine that compares him to Jobs. So that comparison is there. It's very much that analog. But they make a video game together, and it's called The Oasis. It's this all-encompassing VR type thing, even though I guess they're technically using mixed reality headsets, if you think about it. Somebody at Microsoft must have been like,
Spielberg cash, chicka chicka ching chings, ching chings. Give me that. Cash.
So they do. They make this game, and everybody gets into it everywhere, all over the entire world. And Rylance's character, Halliday, James Halliday, dies. So upon dying, triggers this thing where he's like, hey, I hid three keys in the game. You got to find them doing different challenges. And when you get all three, you'll gain control of the Oasis. So basically, it's an adventure movie after that.
Yep.
And I think a large portion of the meaning comes from those challenges, and we'll get into that. But for the most part, it's people coming together while they're trying to complete these tasks, these challenges.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, one of the things that this comes down to thematically is that they really, really get in touch with that. It's doing things on your own is possible, but it's better for you and for everybody to to work with others and be a part of something instead of just being a solo. Like that's a huge chunk of this movie is like right there. It's do it together, because you do it by yourself and you fail.
Well, yeah. So the main character, Parsifal, is his avatar's name.
Wade Watts.
Wade Watts. That's right. Yes. That's his real life name. Says numerous times, I don't clan up, right? He's a lone wolf of sorts, but he's an inexperienced lone wolf of sorts. And that's where his foil comes in, foil, love interest, etc., in Artemis or Samantha. I don't remember her last name, actually.
I don't remember any of their last names except for Wade's.
Okay. Because his dad gave him that name because it sounds like a superhero's secret identity. Mm-hmm. See, I can remember a line from the movie. Look at that.
Gosh. Should've
intro'd you.
Yeah, you should have fixed the intro.
But she's a lone wolf too. But he very much even tells her that, you know, I don't clan up, you know, like whatever. So yeah, there's this thing to togetherness and coming together and stuff like that. Which I think is done well. I think it's handled well.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's fine. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess we haven't really talked about if either one of us liked the movie overall.
Yeah, yet. I think this is one. Let's get to the end of this because I want to finish this out here.
There's a lot that it's. Yeah, my answer will be pretty highly qualified. Maybe I guess is where we're both headed. Either way,
possibly. Which yeah,
it's always been.
Let's not sneak preview it. Let's keep going. Come on, let's chug.
So they are both being egg hunters. They're searching for this Easter egg that Halliday has left.
Gunters.
There it is. They come together and meet at the first challenge, which is ostensibly just a race, wherein he's using the DeLorean. If you've seen all those clips, this is that thing.
That's his car. Like that's what he uses throughout the movie when he's in the Oasis. That's his chosen form of transport.
His best friend H uses Bigfoot.
Yep.
with a bunch of saw blades on the front.
Yeah.
So that's kind of our intro. That's our.
It's also the part where I mean, their relationship kicks off, but it also kicks off in not necessarily a not an unfriendly way, but very much so. They're both reaching for, like, this is a competition, and while they're all competing, you know, they're trying to, at least on some level, they're kind of playing on a fair level. Yeah, yeah. You know, they're not screwing with each other.
They're competitors still,
right?
Standoffish in that way.
Yeah.
And that continues for some time. I mean, I think one of the strongest parts of this movie is how those two characters play off each other throughout the course of the movie. And it's not because they are incredibly new or nuanced characters, really. Like, it's kind of an old trope wherein, you know, Wade is book smarts at best, or he's intuition at best. And he's really good at it. You know, he's kind of a prodigy of sorts. You know, he's the gifted youngster. I don't know, whatever. But Artemis is all experience. Like, she has lived in the real world, and they're very much invested in this thing for different reasons. And this is a scene that comes up later, you know, referring to this dynamic where I'm going to skip some things to get here, but there's a point where they come together and Wade confesses his love to her, because he's known about her from the beginning. Like, the second he sees her, he's like, oh my gosh, that's Artemis, you know? So he has this crush on her already.
Right.
But he's the naive character here. So eventually, in their search for, I think they're at the second challenge by this point, he confesses his love for her, and she says, you don't know who I am, you know, in fact, you don't live in the real world, period. And that's another theme that actually follows this movie throughout, is I mean, like, literally they're going between the real world and the Oasis. But also in that exchange specifically, she calls him out for not living in the real world, period. You know, like, they had just gotten in a firefight because the bad organization here, which is something I skipped over but we'll explain, has sent troops after them to kill them in the world, or to kill their avatars at least. And because when their avatars die, they zero out, they lose all their stuff.
They have nothing left. So when Parsifal zeroes out, he loses his DeLorean, he loses any of the special clothing, any of the things he can change into.
All the money he's built up over time.
Yeah, and that's something that does come up throughout the movie. So that the whole zeroing out concept is kind of the in some ways, that's the thing that's hanging over their head. If they screw up, they're going to zero out and not be able to get back to where they were. But
it carries weight. Like, they want it to be very important, but and I feel like they established that by explaining how important the Oasis is. You know, everybody's playing it all the time, everywhere. You know, it's a big, important thing if you die in the Oasis, because you lose a bunch of the stuff you've built up for however long you've been alive, you know?
Right, and it's also important to note that it's very obvious that in the Oasis, you can purchase things that do come to you in real life. Like, you're online, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And at one point, he buys a suit from bad guys.
So after he gets the first key, which is the first challenge, they go through the race where he and Artemis.
Samantha.
He and Artemis connect for the first time, like, eye to eye, and see each other. When he wins that, he's also given a ton of money because he's the first one to win it. And in doing so, he goes on kind of a shopping spree where he buys, like, a new haptic suit, which gives him more feel in what's going on in the Oasis itself. So he can actually touch things and have things touch him, and he feels it.
Right.
Keeping in mind, this whole movie is, like, stuffed to the gills with nostalgia and references and pop culture. So he buys a Rubik's cube that they call a Zemeckis cube, which, you know, is another Back to the Future reference. Yeah. And so being in the Oasis matters, especially since the real world looks like trash. You know, like, he lives in a place called the Stacks, which is a whole bunch of, like, motorhomes and stuff, and RVs stacked on top of each other, you know, miles high, you know, or stories high, I should say. So it's a significantly nicer place to be, especially for people that live in the Stacks.
And he mentions, like, some, like, the bandwidth riots and the corn syrup droughts and stuff like that. You know, these really world-changing events that he's been through. He lost both of his parents in one of those exchanges, so he's living with his aunt and his aunt's boyfriend. So yeah, but there is a play between the real world and the Oasis throughout, and we'll come back to the characters. I think we should talk about the bad guys up to this point.
IOI,
opposition, IOI, headed up by Ben Mendelsohn, who was maybe a better bad guy as Krennic. But I really like him here.
I like him a lot. I think Ben Mendelsohn in general is great. So he's one of those guys that I will watch just about anything with him in it. And he was great as Krennic. I liked him a lot here. I think he was a very good in the role of whatever his character's name was.
Nolan Sorrento.
Yeah,
he's a great digital bad guy. Like, the first time we see him, he's up in front of his company, like, talking to them about when they win the competition, they think they can safely take up 80% of somebody's field of vision with ads before inducing seizures, is the line.
Right. And I mean, and it perfectly sets up, you're like, you're one step away, by the way. This is already a combination of Demolition Man and Max Headroom. So, like, we are very much so on this line, story-wise.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you mentioned how he got the suit from that, like, when he was, after he won the first challenge, he bought a suit from them. They were the ones that make the haptic suit. Me and the dude I saw the movie with, like, both looked at each other like, what are you doing, like, using hardware from the bad guys? Like, are you crazy? Like, you're obvious. Like, I thought for sure that was going to come back at some point, as he, you know, they have access to all of that because they have spyware built in or something like that, you know?
Right.
Never came back. So I was too advanced on that one, I guess.
It does. It comes back a little bit.
But directly like that. It's like, they never show them hacking into his suit to affect what he's doing.
Why wouldn't they just use that?
Because they have the whole thing where they're like, they send a hitman after his avatar, which, speaking of which, the hitman, I-Rock, is played by TJ Miller, is all of the laughs in the film, basically.
Sure. Sure.
You say sure like you didn't enjoy him as much as I did.
He did not, like, there's a lot here, and TJ Miller was not a welcome part of this movie for me.
Huh. Okay, all right.
And I
laughed at his jokes.
I usually think he's pretty funny, but man, everything about that character, like, his voice didn't match that character for me.
No,
even
not
a little
at all.
Bit.
That was kind
of... And if that was intentional, good. If it wasn't, bad. Either way, it just didn't work for
didn't,
me like
didn't
at
land.
All.
Okay.
No,
yeah,
not
that's cool.
Not at all. That character did
that's
not
cool.
land.
We were talking about Mendelsohn, anyways, yes. as the bad dude. Perfect digital bad guy. He has that thing about the ads. There's also another clip of him shown talking to Halliday and saying, like talking to him about how he can create a subscription, a tiered subscription service to the Oasis.
Right, right.
So they give him these things that are like perfect, you know, things to rally against, like things that we're already rallying against.
Right,
you know,
right. The ads everywhere, of course, yeah, you know, yeah. That'd be the easiest one to point out.
But Ben Mendelsohn still does a fantastic job when he finally meets up with Wade Watts and he puts on that whole show about, come, like, fellow children, you know, like,
oh, totally. Yeah. He totally has the fellow children thing. Yeah. They do.
I'm a cool guy. Like he says, man, like 30 times, like, come on, I'm a man, you know,
and
like,
it's funny because it's another one of those, it's a gatekeeping moment, which is super funny as all hell, because it becomes a, well, I'm not going to talk to you unless you can prove to me that you know things.
Right.
Like, and he's got an earpiece in so that he can try and get Wade to like think that he's cool. But you know, it's a gatekeeping moment that Wade is engaged in. And it's ridiculous.
he tests him by saying, cause one of the first things he says is, man, if I won, I would turn all of the schools in the world into replicas of the schools from Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller. And he's like, oh, hey, that's a great idea. And then he tries to trick him with the schools from Animal House and Fast Times.
Fast Times, that's what it was.
Which they catch him on. But I think that's an interesting, especially as we're going to come back to that kind of real world Oasis dichotomy. I think that's an interesting temptation, because this is before Wade has really, in fact, this is right before Wade has really come to terms with reality. In fact, this might be after that moment I talked about where him and Artemis come together and he confesses his love and she basically blows him off. She's like, I can't be here. You're a distraction. You don't live in the real world. And she takes off, and then he picks up his suit later and this conversation with Ben Mendelsohn happens. But I think the temptation is telling, because he tempts him with this idea of the schools, which is actually a stupid freaking idea if you think about it. Like, it's a cool idea. It's something that a person like Wade Watts, before he comes to terms with reality, would love, because it sounds cool. Like, I get that it's cool, but for education and even just spending the money on that, it's a stupid freaking idea. Like, that's something that definitely sounds cool when you hear it. And then when you actually think about the practicalities, you're like, no, this is stupid. So I think it's telling, because I think this movie deals with that. It's, and I think it flubs it ultimately. We'll get there. But I think it does deal with how important the Oasis is versus how important it should be, and real life versus how important it is and how important it should be.
Sure.
Type thing.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I see what you're getting at. I got you.
Ben Mendelsohn is great.
I'm following your trail of tears. Nope, let's not say that.
Anyways, we're to the second challenge now, which I think these are important, because I think this is where the bulk of the meaning that's stored in this movie comes from, are with these challenges. The first challenge is very much a get to know you thing. It's he gets the answer by looking up the clip from Halliday where he says he hates rules and pedal the metal going backwards. Doesn't mean a whole lot yet. The second challenge, though, is about the leap not taken. And they discover that he went on a date with the woman that became Ogden Morrow's wife, Karen. But he didn't dance with her like she wanted to, and he didn't kiss her at the end of the night. She ended up marrying Ogden Morrow.
The road less taken, the road not taken.
With the second challenge, I think, is where we're getting more into the express meaning that the film wants to convey. And this also leads to the whole, man, I feel like we're just going to get into the weeds with this thing, because there's so much there and
yeah, let's just,
with everything. And some of the bits, like the next bit is the bit they do with The Shining, which is great for people who like The Shining, but if you've never seen it for 10 minutes.
Well, and that's the thing, is if you've never seen The Shining, like, it's totally irrelevant to you.
Oh,
like,
you're not going to get any of it. There's the bloody hallway you've probably seen.
Again, if you're not familiar with it, none of that's going to make sense. Why any of it's happening? It's a very weird sequence. But again, this movie is a movie that in so many ways is meant for people who want to pause every sequence and look for every character and get a sheet together and say, here's who I saw. I found the joust ostrich. I found Freddy. I found Chucky. I found this thing. I found the Shining twins. And in so many ways, if you are not invested in those things or interested in them, even in passing, there's a lot that's going to just not just go flying past you. It's just going to bore you to death. And this is a sequence that one of the people we watched it with was like, I don't get any of this. And it's dumb.
Okay. Well, us being who we are, how did all the references land with you?
I gave up on the references about 5 minutes in. Like, it was so overwhelming and they were so everywhere. I was like, I don't care. Look, we're halfway through this. This movie failed on every level for me.
Really?
I did not enjoy any of this movie. I thought the acting was stiff and bad, especially the real world stuff. And man, that whole like there's a bit early on where we kind of get this. There's supposed to be moments where we're supposed to care about his aunt and the fact that his aunt is very much so just kind of living in this terrible place, and her boyfriend is kind of a jagoff and he goes to punch him and it becomes this thing and you're supposed to care. And it was like, bottom line, this is Spielberg's worst movie, period.
Whoa.
Period. Bottom. This is, I won't ever watch this movie again. It was that bad.
Oh, no, okay. I was going to say that's fine, but I watched it 3 times. So
yeah, and that stuff, the references, and this is something that book also, I like references. I'm a huge fan of pop culture-y things. This is way, way beyond what I want to be interested. Like what I want to, it was seriously so overwhelming. I have in my notes, see where it is. Where is it?
I don't care. Written 500 times.
Maybe 5 minutes in, and I'm already over the background references. Like I stopped. I'm not looking for them all. I don't care.
Okay. Well, stuff
that was forefront, that was right there, was fine. You know, it was cool. Like the Shining bit for me, yeah, it works because I get it all. And that they use the music when they walk into the Shining, like when they open the door
right.
with the key, the music from the movie kicks in. I was like, oh, okay, that was cool. That was super cool. And they go in and they got the carpeting and they totally worked within the framework, and that was cool. So those ones, you know, the Iron Giant, which if you've seen any of the commercials, you know, the Iron Giant shows up eventually. That was great. You know, like seeing the Iron Giant. But yeah, when it came to any of the stuff in the background, I seriously just, and especially the big sprawling scenes, like, nope, it was just all gray to me. Looking.
That's fine. I never got tired of it, but I wasn't, I guess I did stop looking for it somewhat as well, honestly. But that's maybe because I got more wrapped up in the movie. Like, I didn't dislike it. It's definitely not Spielberg's strongest.
I tried to get wrapped up in it, man. I did. It was Ty Sheridan, the guy who plays Wade Watts. I'm sorry. If that kid's a good actor, he wasn't here. This is bad.
No, like, in
this
fact, is I straight, would agree with you on the real this, world.
This is
stuff.
Straight. The only parts in the real world that worked were Ben Mendelsohn. He was actually good.
Yeah,
all of his sequences in the real world, which ironically I actually kind of hated the Oasis version of his character. I was like, that's not what I think he would make himself look like. Like, I didn't think he would make himself look like that.
His avatar. Yeah.
It was, I mean, it was definitely a little closer to the, I guess the, like the Gaston, you know, from Beauty and the Beast, which is, is pretty good.
It's funny to hear you mention that though, actually, because there was, I remember seeing an interview with Spielberg about how he didn't want to do this movie unless the avatar stuff could be done right. And actually, I guess I would say for the most part, like the motion capture, it still looks like you're watching a CGI movie.
Right. There is no, at any point, there's no attempt to uncanny valley this. Like they all look,
right.
All of the, when they're in the Oasis, you know, that's when people like you find out essentially that, you know, if you've seen any of those sprawling scenes where you see Freddy get shot or you see Tracer or whatever, those are people using those avatars as themselves.
Right.
So potentially there could be hundreds of Freddies or whatever. So everybody is cartoony-ish, and it looks like, you know, a fairly high-end video game at the, you know, kind of movie.
It doesn't
thing,
even look
know?
Like,
I mean,
which
but it
I
doesn't
guess
look
I
like a video game either. It's weird.
No, it just looks like a CGI movie. It's a cartoon,
yeah.
Which is, I guess I was fine with it in that way, but
right.
Okay, so actually knowing how you feel then, I'm going to cut right to what I think, because the movie is weak in a lot of ways. I don't have the reverence for the book, but I think there is a lot here. I think, and say what you will about Spielberg, he doesn't make a movie without like making a movie. Like this isn't, this is a strange movie to talk about because with all the references and there, how there is so much, I feel like that's this story. Like I know all of that is in the book to some extent. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like, this isn't this without that type thing. I get that, but Spielberg doesn't make a movie without giving you something more than what's on the surface. He just doesn't.
Sure.
So having talked about what we just talked about, let's just cut to that, actually. Chronologically, they get the second key from The Shining. They find out where the third challenge is. It's playing the Atari game Adventure. And this is probably also where the bulk of the extra time, I mean, now that I know you don't like the entire movie, I guess that's I knew for sure you were going to take issue with the length of the film. I didn't know it was going to be all 219 minutes of it.
Yeah, that was so, a lot of minutes there.
I think the majority of the extra time in this movie comes in the third act because it's the whole, there's basically a war, you know, he has a call to arms to everybody else and they all show up with all their avatars and it's them versus IOI, you know, all out. And IOI has built up a big force field around the final challenge so nobody else can get in. So there is this rising up and they pull out a lot of references for the whole thing. So this is probably where they take their time with some of it. Even then, I didn't mind still. It seems strange to say. So.
No, I mean, it was just when that scene occurred, when the big battle fight thing happens and he does his call to arms, it was, all right, cool. There's going to be a ton of things here. And it became like a visual overload of, there's so much here. I just, like, I'm not going to bother with it. It's sure. gobbledygook. You know, it's like if I was 12, man, I would be sitting there and I'd be that kid, man. I'd pause the movie and be like, oh, look, there's this and there's that. And there's this. I'm not 12 anymore. And things like this that are so overwrought, just give me the story so that all of that stuff is a nice to have. The movie doesn't hit the story. That's the thing. This movie drops. And say what you will about Spielberg. Maybe he's got something to say. In my opinion, he drops so much of the story here. It's so disjointed that anything he was trying to say is muddled to me. And it doesn't say anything other than I've learned that this the book and this story very much have a gatekeeping feel around them. And I get that because it's supposed to be a love letter. It doesn't feel like a love letter to me, though. Like, it never felt like a love letter to nostalgia. It feels like, man, ugh.
You know what? I actually agree that the message is muddled. I think it's there, and I still want to talk about what I think it is.
Sure.
But I agree that it's muddled, and I think they didn't, especially with the last line, the last 2 seconds of this movie, they totally bork it. But I also like that you brought up the whole gatekeeping aspect, because I think there is a generational thing going on here. But mm-hmm. I think we might disagree on what that thing is, because
sure.
there are two generations at play here. There's the generation, it's Halliday and Ogden Morrow's generation that created the game. And there's Wade Watt's generation, basically, the kids who have picked up on the game. You know, those are the two, even though everybody's playing that game, I think those are the two generations at play here. I don't think it comes out against one or the other. And I think, number one, because Nolan Sorrento, Ben Mendelsohn, is of the same, like, in fact, of the same generation, came up working with Halliday and Ogden Morrow.
Right.
You know, the gods are of the same generation, are still the good guy. But the message I think this movie is trying to talk about comes at the end, where Wade Watts gets to play through the final challenge, which is the Atari game Adventure. And it's not even, there's a cool part at the end. This is also my favorite challenge of the bunch. I think it's what the movie hangs its hat on more than anything.
Sure.
And it's not about winning, because that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to beat the game Adventure, and they beat the game Adventure, and then they lose, because it wasn't about winning the whole time. And the line here is, I mean, the game is called Adventure, not by accident. It's also the first game where there's an Easter egg where you go and get the thing and bring it back to the beginning, and it tells you who made the game, right? But the fact that they're telling you right then that even when it comes to games, like, winning isn't the thing, right? This small thing, which is important, you know, I mean, you can have a discussion about the ending of a game here and there, for sure, especially the way the thing games have become and whatnot. But
yeah, and if you want to hear us talk about that, go to zerohitpoints.com.
But seeing as the Oasis was never meant to be a single player game, there's a quote for you from Ogden Morrow. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no story component per se to this thing. It's very much a statement that the play is the thing. Oh my gosh. I just accidentally did Shakespeare'd Hamlet. You Shakespeare'd
yourself.
Good gosh.
Well done. Well done, sir.
Oh.
Somebody went to college.
No, so I love that's the final thing, because to me that's a beautiful statement, right? That I couldn't agree more with anything in this entire movie. You know, like, the adventure is the thing, playing the game is the thing.
Yeah,
you know?
It's the journey, it's not the destination. You know,
there you
I mean,
go.
It's sure. Again, the problem I have is that while this movie may have tried to get that across, it does a poor job of that, and it does a poor job of it because to me, the movie's adventure is not, there's nothing there.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's like, a funny statement there. Yeah.
And because I agree that I can see that being the reasoning, right? But like, there is no point during this movie where I actually was concerned anything was going to happen to them. In the book, Daito, who is one of the high five, at some point, yeah, they get called. Who knows when there. That happens?
You must be one of the high five. I'm like, they're the high five?
When did that happen? I actually have the high five. When did this happen? In the book, he's actually killed. Like, there is a real world consequence. They murder him. They throw him off a building while he's in the Oasis. Right. And that right there,
way better.
Movie is already way more interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So much of this story, so much of it, just feels like we go from point A to point Z real fast, and we shouldn't be there yet. Like you talked about how right away we find out that Wade is super infatuated with Artemis, and that she immediately is like, no, 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 you don't even know me. And then 10, 15 minutes later, she's like, okay, we're best friends now. And then there's really fast switch. Really quick. And it happens with everybody. Like, there is no character development in this movie outside of Wade. And I'm sorry, man, I don't even think Wade got good character development, because I didn't know or care anything about his aunt. They blow his family up.
Dude, the film has, for lack of a better word, the film has a weight problem. Like, it tries to give weight to these things, and yeah, that's the thing that happens. Flubs. Right after he's done talking with Ben Mendelsohn, is they blow up his aunt and her boyfriend, and right after that, he's kidnapped by Samantha and brought into the real world where she's at, and kind of never mentions his aunt ever again. Aunt, why did I say it like that? This is the most Shakespearean show we've ever done. It actually mentions his aunt again when he's got a gun to Mendelsohn's face later on, but never, like, he's not sad. Like,
no.
he's more happy to see her than anything, and kind of looks off into the distance and talks about, he's not like, he should be overwrought. That's where overwrought should actually happen in this movie.
Totally agree. and so you end up with these, like, the motivations are not clear, and the motivations they do have are, we just want to beat the corporation out. Okay. I mean, good motivation, fine. But for all the crap that's happening, like, again, your home was just exploded. Yeah.
Like, even in the Oasis, where they've tried to establish how important it is to be in there, like, there are times where they don't really talk about, and I guess talking about rules isn't the way to fix this thing, but there are, like, they don't explain the Oasis all that much. They try, sure, to lay a groundwork where it's a video game, and if you think about it more, you can be like, okay, yeah, I guess that makes sense that there are artifacts within this thing. They don't ever really tell you the limits, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, right. I don't know why people aren't just flying everywhere, you know? Like there's a line, in fact, this is good. There's a line in The Matrix where at one point they need to explain why, you know, everybody can't just do everything,
yes,
all the time.
Yes.
And it's something along the lines of it's built on rules, or I think it's when they're talking to the architect or something like that. And it's even though they're in this simulation, this matrix, it's built on rules. You know, this is why they have to go and perform the heist in the second or third movie. I can't remember. They don't have a line like that.
Well, and that's
so there are points in the Oasis where I'm like, why don't they, I don't understand why they have to do that.
Right.
Or why that's an obstacle even, you know?
No, 100%. Like, and that's the other thing is movies have rules. All these worlds that exist, they have rules. And the movies that successfully hold on to the rules, they establish them, and then they work within the confines of them. You know, you take a movie like The Thing. The Thing is a great example of taking a movie, creating rules around it, and staying within the confines. Yeah, it's a smaller movie in terms of the size, but that doesn't change how it's done. And you know,
all the Thing references kind of threw me off after a while.
Just so many, tons of them. I just there was an entire world of Kurt Russells, just different era Russells. People were
now you're just describing your favorite movie.
Captain,
a Ready Player One that's just Kurt Russell references.
Yeah, Captain Ron's and you know and R.J. McCready's over
we
here.
We did it. We fixed another movie here on whatever we are. Book club for movies. I want to end with the end of the movie because I do think Spielberg knows that he has to say something here. I think he is saying it, and I think a lot of it does come in that final scene with Halliday and Watts, which he gets the final key, he puts it in the door, he goes through one final test where he didn't sign the contract, which I think they probably could have left out. I mean, I get it's one of those things where I'm like, I get this was more of a thing, but it just makes it seem weird because like 5 minutes later he's signing a contract.
Well, and the other thing about that really bothers me is it's like the Last Crusade, except you don't have the other person to sign it to melt away, like to drink
which
from
is always
to,
a down yeah
which,
that's,
yeah if you're
don't
not
do it
if you're not melting the bad guy you're doing your
you're
movie
doing
wrong.
It wrong yeah no
again this movie has no teeth to it at any point. You're like, well, this is just gonna work out.
I totally agree with that. In fact, that's gonna come with my final statement, I think, here, because he does not sign that contract, and then that's a final test that he passes, and the avatars fade away. It's just Halliday, and he's in his room with Wade, or Wade's avatar, I guess, still at this point, and there's a younger version of himself off in the corner playing Atari, and he says, oh, that's just me from a long time ago. I like to have him around from time to time. Shows him where the Oasis kill switch is, and then begins looking for the actual Easter egg while telling him kind of his life story about how he spent most of his life being afraid. You know, there was that second challenge where he didn't take the leap. He's like, that was most of my life. I missed a lot of opportunities, is what he says. And basically everything the movie has to say about the difference between kind of real life and the Oasis comes down to this moment. And he has a line about how reality is the only place where you can get a decent meal. Great line. It's way better than what he follows with reality being real or something like that.
Right.
Okay. That's
should have stopped it right there. You had it.
Yeah. And it goes downhill. Like they really should have stopped it there, because he does find the egg. He gives it to Wade and he's holding it. They show him, you know, in his haptic suit in the real world, holding it too. And they can see where he's holding it. And it's the thing, you know, like Ben Mendelsohn finally comes up to their van with a gun, finds him holding the egg, and can't follow through. Like I want to say a smile even starts to crack. Like that egg has such power that even him, there's no like turnaround. There's no, I mean, he does get caught and taken away, but there's no like outside force stopping him except that egg, except that Easter egg that's within the game.
Right.
Right.
There. Well, and that's that moment where I feel like, I feel like when it comes down to the gamification of this movie, that's the moment where Ben Mendelsohn's character realizes the game is over. I got beat. And he's instead of him being a bad sport and shooting him, he's essentially GG.
That's actually pretty cool. I like that read.
That's how I read it. And then there are like, you see, and the reason that kicked into my head too was there's, as the camera pulls back when they're arresting him, which, by the way, there's a huge explosion here. Where were the cops then? Nobody knows.
Like the cops of the city.
They just show up
for no reason.
Yeah. There are people that had signs that said GG Artemis or GG Parzival. And I was
really?
and I went, you know what? It. That's totally that face. Ben Mendelsohn's character could never, he's that guy that could never bring himself to maybe say GG, but it's that. All right.
That's cool. I like that read.
You won.
And that's just after Halliday leaves, basically. They hint that it's actually Halliday, that he transferred his consciousness into the Oasis, basically.
Right.
But he leaves with a line that just says, hey. Or no, he doesn't say hey. Actually, that's too cool. He says, he gathers up his younger self, and as he's heading out the door, says, thanks for playing my game, and leaves. Which I thought was actually a pretty cool, kind of sweet moment.
The ending sequence, that last little bit, including the thing with Mendelsohn, it is probably the best part of the movie in terms of like that is the most Spielbergian parts of the movie. Like I yes. did enjoy the kind of running gag of the door opens, it's Ben Mendelsohn holding the gun. They close the door. They open the door again, and it's Ogden, and he's saying, "We want to do this. We want to. We've got some people out here who want you to sign a contract." And Wade says, "Hold on." They close the door. Then they open the door again, and somebody else is like, "Cops want to talk to you." And that's when H, who we find out, H is this like in the movie looks like this giant ogre-y. What was that character supposed to be? I don't know.
It wasn't a reference to a movie from the 80s, so I have no idea.
Super, super deep voice and everything, and then you find out that it's this like this black woman that's just been cruising around in a an old mail truck, and
that's one of the great messages of the movie is that it doesn't matter, like all these misfits doesn't matter who you are, who you're portraying yourself as. Oh, okay, I mean it does, but it's, you know, there are several lines important. Throughout the film that are like, are you surprised? It's not what you expected, or you know, she's embarrassed because she has a birthmark and she thinks, you know, everybody's going to judge her and that's why she's a different person online. So there is that commentary.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any teeth like the rest of the movie, but you know, they come down on the right side for what it's worth.
They do. It is. I think the last thing I'll say about this is that the movie is saccharine and the problem I think ultimately with this particular type of saccharine is that it doesn't have teeth behind it. And it also was so disjointed that where the sweetness comes from, it's like, oh, that was cute. And that was sweet. And that was nice. And that could have mattered. But the rest of this movie is just not on the same level. It doesn't. Like Halliday's final words of thanks for playing my game. I totally was like, man, that is an awesome way for him to walk away, and the sentiment and that whole concept, like that idea. And it just was like, but you didn't follow it up with anything. There's nothing.
Oh, they did. And well, I mean, and that's, I mean, so yeah, at that moment when he walks away, I had written some, like at its best, I think if this movie gets to say what it might be trying to say, or maybe what the book is actually probably saying and does a better job of saying, there's a moment where, and this becomes personal because we are of the generation that would technically be, you know, Halliday and Morrow. Mm-hmm. And there's a point where I'm like, okay, you know, we are Halliday and Morrow. Like we're the ones that kind of pioneered and engineered this digital world that our children are inheriting. And there is a question about, you know, how do we pass that on type thing? Not only, or how do we pass it on responsibly almost type thing, which I think is it's an age old question, whatever. And I think if this were done right, you know, and maybe the book does do it right, that's pretty heavy. That's pretty cool. And I think there's a really nuanced way to do that. And I think for the most part, the film kind of does do that almost accidentally, it seems at times. Like it does give a very nuanced view of, you know, what is more important, reality or the game world. You know, because there are very much things in these virtual worlds that are real, that older generations kind of rally against because they don't understand. You know, like there's still people out there that think meeting on the internet is stupid or weird or freakish, you know, or it's something like that. You know,
I
like,
sure do.
Right? But it's normal and it's healthy, you know, and it's connecting, you know, and it's not in the real world technically, you know, or in this movie it wouldn't have been.
Right.
But the movie keeps going and Wade signs the contract and he gets the Oasis. And the last line is freaking, we decided to close the Oasis on Tuesdays and Thursdays because people need to spend more time in the real world because reality is the only thing that's real.
Yeah, like that was...
Comes down solidly on the side of reality, mm-hmm. which, yes, reality is very important, probably more important than the Oasis, but they spent the entire movie kind of giving a more nuanced answer that's not, you know... It's not the 2 second conversation, you know, like you're having an argument or a conversation with somebody about this and they give you that line and you're like, no, like we haven't, that's a wrong answer at this point because there's way more, you know, stuff to talk about here.
I was going to say, like,
end the movie like that.
I love that they torpedo the entire rest of the movie with that line. It's like, hey, let's go ahead and nuke it with the last line of the movie. Everything you just watched, garbage.
So, yeah. I guess I guess that's an appropriate ending for the way the rest of it went. But
Ready Player One, that's what we had to say about it. I would love to hear what other people have to say about this movie.
12 stars.
Out of 58. that's where we're going with Ready Player One. Podcast at bookclubformovies.com. We had to finish it. You know what? We did a book adaption this week. Let's just keep it up and do another one. I think next week, the book club for movie selection will be Madeline L'Engle's by way of Ava DuVernay, Wrinkle in Time.
A Wrinkle in Time. It made it back. We pushed this for what? Was it Lost Boys, weeks.
Boys and that. So
the Lost Boys of our time, A Wrinkle in Time, everybody. Check it out.
A Wrinkle in Lost Time.
A Wrinkle in Lost Boy Time.
That one's going to be available for you to rent out on the Xbox and the PS4. It's not streaming just yet, but you can find it on the VODs. So do that. Book Club for Movies. We're here on Thursdays. Podcast, bookclubformovies.com. Let us know what you think. And with that all being said, let's just do the rest of the show.
So I'm going to go first here, because mine comes from Spielberg. In fact, the final question I was going to ask you about Ready Player One is if you think it should have been directed by somebody different, essentially.
Oh, wow. You know, I think that's a really good question. I don't know that anybody would have done it better. I don't know that.
Okay, good.
So I guess he, it's hard because I have to go back to Zach Penn and also say, Does this movie do better with a different writer? That's, I think, where I'm at. I don't know if Zach Penn was the right guy to adapt it.
Well, so I think it would have been better served by a different director. And I watched two other Spielberg movies this week. I think the reason that Ready Player One would have been served better by a different director is because I think a lot of where we talk about toothlessness with that thing kind of came from that. Like, that's Spielbergian, man. Like,
it is.
He doesn't do a whole lot of movies with teeth. Like, he's the popcorn guy, and that's fantastic. He's given us some of the greatest popcorn movies of all time. Like,
Jaws.
Yeah. It's the first blockbuster.
Raiders, Indiana Jones,
all of
Crusade,
these things. There's Temple, he's made a few good movies.
A couple of them, but not a few good men.
No, he didn't make that one.
He didn't make that one.
I couldn't tell you who did off the top of my head, and I probably should.
Brian De Palma.
It was Tom Cruise.
It was, right. Yeah, also not Brian De Palma.
So I did watch two other Spielberg movies because late era Spielberg here, which for me kind of begins with Bridge of Spies. That was the latest, I feel like, Spielberg that I've seen where it's just been a different Spielberg for me.
Sure.
The other two movies I saw, the first was The Post, and I feel like I should have more to say about this because I really, really liked it. I'm full disclosure, and this will come in on the second movie I saw too, a history buff.
Right. And this is one I still really want to watch because I love the cast. The story is a great story. And this is one that
are excellent.
It's one that I feel like Spielberg's going to knock this out of the park. Like, this is,
he does.
Yeah.
Because it brings kind of that old school positivity that he does do.
Sure.
To these real life situations. Like, The Post is this fantastical depiction of how things used to be compared to how they are now, you know?
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
It's insane. You know, and I try not to get too down, but I know the most depressing thing about all of it is, you know, some people see this and just dismiss it outright or call it, you know, liberal hogwash. Probably using those exact words.
100%. It's a very common phrase.
But it's not, man. It's such a wonderful, like, I'm so glad this thing exists. The story is great, but it's also it's just stuff that, like, people need to relearn in the worst and the best way, you know. it's just really good. Like, I don't know why I don't have more to say about it. It might be because the other one I watched I loved even more, like, hands down. And again, history buff here, but I watched Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln. All right. I was wondering if that's where you were going with this.
So good.
Really? Really?
So
you like that one, huh?
I freaking loved it. And I wasn't really set up to, because again, I mean, I liked Bridge of Spies too, but I haven't really connected with a lot of later Spielberg stuff. This one, I remember when I first heard about it. In fact, I think I might have been in college. It sounded like a freaking SNL skit, man.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Spielberg, you know, starring not Molly,
Daniel Day-Lewis.
What's her name? Daniel Day-Lewis. And I mean, it starts everybody, but
and Sally Field.
Sally Field, that's the one I can't even think of. It sounded like an SNL skit, man. Like you could have shown me the trailer from that and put a punchline at the end. I would have been like, oh, man, that was pretty good. So I didn't necessarily hold out, like, super high hopes for this thing. But it's basically couched all in terms of the 13th Amendment, like getting that passed and what Lincoln had to do. And I mean, number one, Daniel Day-Lewis, like, I guess maybe he's oversold sometimes and he plays weird characters or whatever, but he is what he is, man. Like, the hype is real here for as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can say a lot of things about him, but you can't ever say he doesn't love that craft. You know, you may not like him,
man,
but man, he loves the craft. He is,
the weird thing is the things I feel like you would say about him don't fit with this character. Like, you feel like the stuff you hear about him is that, like, you know, whatever, him being hard to work with or whatever. Like, you feel like, well, Lincoln's going to be a challenge because this guy is a pretty nice guy. You know, they're not going to give you a dirty Lincoln in this movie. Spielberg's not going to give you dirty Lincoln.
Dirty Lincoln. You know, dirty Lincoln. That's our movie.
But he does, man. He comes across as just the most, I mean, some of the performances in Sally Fields, I think, I'm not more often than not, but there are certain times, are melodramatic. Like, it seems melodramatic, you know?
Sally Field is she can do that for sure.
Well, the weird part is, it fits.
Oh,
like, yeah. It gets melodramatic, but you're like, man, like, the dude's already wearing a top hat. Like, this is the time where, like, he doesn't have a mustache to twirl. And he's not the bad guy, but
yeah, he's not the butcher. What's his butcher Bill from King of New York, or not King of New York, Gangs of New York.
King Bill Pullman is the King of New York. But that's okay.
Yeah, by way of Christopher Walken.
But yeah, it weirdly fits, and even though it is kind of given that positive spin, and there's patriotism here, it's done. Realistically, and I haven't done the thing I do with Wikipedia to find out how much I actually dislike this movie after the fact, but the historical portrayal is one of Lincoln like playing politics, man. Like, on the other hand, it makes me it makes me depressed about what politics is and has always been. Mm-hmm. Because I'm the guy that will vote for the guy who's going to lose because, you know, I can't vote against my conscience type thing.
Sure, sure.
You know, people very close to me will vote against their conscience because they don't want the other guy to win, you know, and I freaking hate politics like that. But here, like, Lincoln, you know, burns ledgers. He sends people out to kind, not necessarily buy votes. Like, there is no bribery here, and they talk about that. But, you know, there's wheeling and dealing, man, and Lincoln's in on it, and he makes some backroom visits to I'll tell you how bad it gets, to James Spader, of all people.
The Blacklist himself.
Dude, he's good in this movie.
James Spader's always good.
Well, he's always good, but he's always James Spader. You know, like I liked him in Ultron, like in Age of Ultron, but he was just James Spader.
I love that's the comparison. You're like, let me talk about the Spielberg's Lincoln and also Age of Ultron. It's James Spader's two highest achievements. You know, it's like
it was,
I don't know.
The last thing I saw him in, but also he seemed like James Spader at the most Spaderiest. But I think you're right. That's probably Blacklist.
Between Lincoln and his role as Robert California on The Office, I don't know.
But he's good. He plays he actually has chops in this thing. He actually has sideburns as well. So he's got all of the chops.
It's dual purpose.
He's super enjoyable. Because he plays one of those backroom guys where they send him out to kind of get votes from the Democrats who aren't turning to pass the 13th Amendment. And the story is very tense because it's in the middle of the Civil War, and it's at a point where Lincoln knows if the Civil War ends, he won't be able to pass the 13th Amendment. So there's this delegation from the South that's kind of on their way that he has to stall, because if he starts having peace talks with the South and people hear that peace talks are on the table, again, the war is just going to be over and nobody's going to want the 13th Amendment. So it's this wheeling dealing thing. There's this tense thing where people are held off, and there's these actual debates, you know, in the middle. And Tommy Lee Jones, whose initial appearance I wasn't stoked on, like, I think it might be his best movie, or certainly, I mean, it's a different movie than like The Fugitive or something, but he does a fantastic job. He has the line at the end where he brings the literal 13th Amendment, you know, he takes it. I don't know if this is truthful or not. Again, I didn't look up how much I don't like this portion or not, but he brings it to his wife, who used to be a slave that he's, you know, it's actually paid by Law and Order. Gosh dang it. Mm-hmm. Samantha.
CCH Pounder.
Yeah. I don't think that's her name, but I'm not going to disagree for the time being. And he has the line at the end that just says the greatest, like he hands her the 13th Amendment and he's like, the greatest measure of the 19th century passed by corruption, aid and abetted by the purest man in America. So that sums up the movie pretty well. It's really, really good. I don't know if anybody's gonna like it as much as I did, you know, coming from my background. And but it made me thankful for this period in Spielberg's life where I hadn't been just yet, because I wasn't sure, because he does lend that kind of positivity and that also, oh shoot, dude, I gotta mention this movie is a miracle of natural light.
Oh yeah,
it's unbelievable.
Did they use a ton of candlelight, natural light?
Like, I'm sure there's some fudging going on there, but sure. it's amazing, man.
Love
it's
that.
It's really good.
Well, dude. And when you're making movies about things like that, you can't use anything except for the things that existed at that time. So like, I don't even know how they got film working, but it was incredible. It was cameras.
Cool. It's good. I'm sorry. I went on as long as I did. Please.
No, man, I gotta check that out. It's another one I've never seen. I don't. Daniel Day-Lewis, yeah, he's hit or miss for me in so many ways.
Did you like There Will Be Blood?
I did not like There Will Be Blood. Okay. That movie misses for me on a twofer, because I think that Paul Thomas Anderson is maybe the director that has
overrated. Maybe
I don't know. I won't say he's overrated, because I don't know that that's the right phrasing. I legitimately watch his movies and think this movie, like, it just feels like you're chewing your own face when you wrote it. Like, and I don't know, maybe the dude is like the coolest guy in Hollywood, just the way his movies come out. And I felt that with Boogie Nights. I really cannot stand Magnolia. I think Magnolia is just, like 2.5 hours of just somebody please kick every one of these actors in the head.
Like he's doubling, tripling, quadrupling down at least, because Phantom Thread looks like indecipherable.
And apparently it's great, but apparently it's fantastic. Okay. Yeah, that's one that, like, and that's one I'll probably end up watching, because it's that will something Beth will be really interested in. Like, she likes historical stuff and involving that kind of like fashion type stuff. And it's not the fashion so much as it is the person behind it. Really interesting to her. So
did you ever see the freaking Scientology one? Camera Maker? Master?
Oh, the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix. Master. Never saw that one either. And I did hear that was actually really, really great. That was supposed to be excellent. Never watched it, though. Because, again, it's like that has two actors that I love in it. But with that director, I have such a hard time. And I'm just not, he doesn't have a track record for me that I want to go back to.
Right, so. Gotcha. Mortal Kombat is probably my favorite of his.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than Event Horizon. Again, I go back to that too, and I just
solid.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to preface what I watched here with a little history.
I love it.
So as most of you know, as I'm sure you know, horror movies are definitely my go to. They're the thing.
Enjoy them?
I do. I like them a bit. When I was very small, you know, we watched, my dad and I watched lots of horror movies. We watched lots of things like Svengoolie when he was available, the Elvira stuff, the horror hosts. They were on TV and it was, you know, those evolutions that came from the Rod Serling with Twilight Zone that became that, you know, again, the Elviras and all that, that they would show your movie and then you know, you'd have a cut in between the movie somewhere before a commercial break and they would talk and there'd be some kind of a thing and they'd go back to the movie.
I like it.
So
the lost art.
It, really. It totally is. It's like they still exist. They're just harder to find. And when I was younger, the one that was around for the longest for me was this guy named Joe Bob Briggs. And he started off on the Movie Channel, and which was like a pay channel, like Showtime. He was originally like a comic, and he wrote movie reviews and he has a history of loving film and being involved in things and Joe Bob Briggs is the character's name. You know, his real name is like Joe Bolton or John Bolton or something like that. I can't remember what his actual name is.
That's not that far away.
No. It's he's a Texan.
It's like Joe Robert.
But he chose the name specifically because he was like, you know what, I'll do this. It'll be fun to be kind of a hillbilly. And he ended up finding this niche where B movies and cult movies were the thing that he just really liked. And he would review them in a very earnest and real manner. But he had fun with it. And his written articles, like where he first started, they were very much like he would write a wrapper around these things about how he's getting to the drive-in, and he considered them all drive-in movies. So it was called the, you know, Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs when it moved to TNT, and it was the drive-in or the drive-in with Joe Bob Briggs on TNT, and so these movies were great. They were like all sorts of like 2001 Maniacs and all these things from Herschel Gordon Lewis, and one of the hallmarks of the show was that he had a mail bag, of course, and so he had a mail girl, and it was obnoxious, and at the end of the show, he would come up with his drive-in totals, and the drive-in totals were things that were like how many there was a 14 blindfolded aardvarkings and 15 instances of paddle foo, which is you add foo to the end of anything that involved somebody grabbed a weapon, and that was the thing they used to fight somebody off with.
Yes, okay,
and so he came up with these totals, and they were just silly and ridiculous and part of the movie. And then in the mid to late 2000s, the formatting changed and it just went away. Monster Vision was taken off of TNT. He'd been off of the movie channel for years, which doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. But he'd been still doing stuff. He writes, does scripting. He still does comedy shows. He does talks at schools, at colleges and stuff. He's a smart dude. And Shudder had him. They got him to do a 24-hour. They called it the last drive-in with Joe Bob Briggs on Friday the 13th, and they just streamed 13 movies in a row with his style of they do the break and they'd cut to him and he'd do his things, and one of the best parts is that not only did he grow up like with so many of these different directors, and he got to know all these people because they're small budget films. These weren't big budget things. So he got to know a lot of these people, and he has amazing stories about how a movie got made, where it was shot, who did this, why this happened, and all these really weird, goofy stories and how they interact in a, and so they did that. They brought all of it back. He had a male girl and he had some guests on, and he did his they cut away. They came back to the movies and it was all uncut films. So it was great. And I watched a decent chunk of it. I had it kind of on in the background at all times and was checking in with it. They had some they did have a couple of hiccups throughout the stream. So it didn't wasn't running perfectly, but all of this stuff was actually re-put its backup on Shudder with his stuff inside of it.
Wait, were they doing this semi-live or
it
something?
It was semi-live, yeah. It was, well, it was live.
Or broadcast.
It was broadcast. Yeah, it was a live broadcast. And so they've taken all of them, they've cut them up in the way that they fit so that you can watch the movies. But the list of movies was, he picked them all, and just such a great collection of horror movies. And if you haven't seen any of these, I highly recommend you check them all out. I'm not going to detail anything here. I'm just going to tell you what they all were. Top to bottom, this was The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs, found on Shudder, streaming there. So check this out. In order.
Is Shudder just like, is that run completely by people who know you personally?
It feels like it sometimes. It's great. I think they're owned by AMC actually, and they're just, that's all they do. So the movie list is as follows: Tourist Trap, Sleepaway Camp, Rabid, The Prowler, Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bowlerama, a personal favorite, Daughters of Darkness, the one movie out of all 13 that I've never actually seen. Blood Feast, Basket Case, Reanimator, Demons, The Legend of Boggy Creek, Hellraiser, and it capped everything off with Pieces. I actually own all of these movies except for Daughters of Darkness, and I don't have a copy of Sorority Babes and Slimeball Bowlerama, but
I own can change that. The Mystery Science Theater of Boggy Creek.
Boggy Creek's a good movie.
It might be Boggy Creek 2.
Electric Boogaloo. All of these are fun. They all have their things going for them. Rabid is a big standout. It was Cronenberg's first real movie. And it has some real weird stuff in it. It's definitely that thing where you go, oh, this is David Cronenberg for sure. Basket Case has some really incredible, really fun Foley work and some really good practical effects. There's some real weird stuff going on in there. Reanimator is a top tier, one of my all timers. Absolutely love it. Jeffrey Combs.
I feel like we've talked about that on the combo show
that existed before. It has come up. Hellraiser is a highlight, of course. Love that, Clive Barker. It was fun, man. It was, and one of the cool things that I really, really hope that they bring him back for a weekly thing or a bi-weekly or a monthly something, is that the amount of people watching that and that we're talking on Twitter and that we're like going back and forth. I don't remember the last time. Like it's the best live stream experience I could possibly have.
That's
you
cool.
know, this is, it's like, it's instead of doing the funny Mystery Science Theater 3000 thing, it's a whole bunch of nerds talking about horror movies, like as if they matter, because they matter to us. And you know, and it was great, man. Joe Bob Briggs was clearly having a ton of fun. He was retweeting people, he was responding to people. And it went over really well. And I hope, again, I hope Shudder does another edition of The Last Drive-In, does another drive-in with Joe Bob Briggs.
Say, yeah, they could. I feel like calling it The Last Drive-In does not mean they can't do a last drive-in.
It's,
know,
horror,
like,
movies,
keep,
man.
Keep going, yeah.
When is a horror movie ever ended, right? When you can't kill Michael
not
Myers.
Not a one.
You can't kill Freddy. They come back. Joe Bob Briggs, he'll be back.
He'll be back. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's 1997.
That's right. And that's going to be the show. That's the book club for movies. Next week, again, our book club for movie selection is going to be A Wrinkle in Time. Again, streaming on your VOD things, not available currently on Netflix or Hulu, anything like that.
Here's a preview for you. This will give you a good insight to what that show is going to be.
Tell me.
I never understood the title of A Wrinkle in Time. I thought it was saying, like, we're going to have a wrinkle in time, everybody.
Like a wrinkle in time? Like it's a good, going to be real hooting and hollering
no,
wrinkle
like,
in time.
Like yep. Yep.
Did you think the movie was just about sitting in like a pool?
I have no idea.
Or the book's about a pool?
I still don't know.
Hey, kids, you want to go have a wrinkle in time? Everybody get your pools on. Let's go.
But then I went to college and... etc.
You went to college. Podcast at bookloveformovies.com, where we, one of us, went to college and the other one is still talking.
I don't know who's who.
We've got the right to choose it.